This isn't about trying to penalize anybody, trying to put a gun to anybody's head. It's time to monetize our resources.
Governor Walker explains his proposal for a reserves tax. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, September 25th. Good evening, I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, budget cuts mean no overtime for state snowplow drivers this year.
When we have a really big snowstorm or, you know, freezing rain, we'll have to stay with the scheduled staff and scheduled equipment that we have.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. There is still time to start the Business Administration and Management Program at Alaska Pacific University. Module 2 courses start on Wednesday, October 21st. More at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
The National Transportation Safety Board released a preliminary report today on the September 15th crash of a Turbine Otter floatplane in Iliamna. The accident killed 3 and wounded 7 on board. The plane was owned and operated by the Rainbow King Lodge and left before dawn to take clients and guides to a day of fishing on a river northwest of Kodiak. The NTSB has not concluded what caused the accident, but the report details a statement from the only eyewitness that dark morning. The van driver for the lodge was able to watch as the otter took off, says NTSB Alaska Office Chief Clint Johnson.
And what he explained to us was he saw the airplane initially rotate and become airborne. And shortly after that, the airplane descended, struck the floats on the water again. The airplane again bounced back in the air, or at least became airborne again. And at that point, descended behind some trees and out of his sight. And he was the one that actually got the first 911 call off and got the rescuers headed that way.
The plane crashed not far from the end of East Wind Lake. Volunteers from Iliamna and Non-Dalton and a state trooper helped pull the survivors from the wreckage and transported them to the village clinic, where they were treated and later medevaced to Anchorage. Johnson says the NTSB has since spoken with all the survivors, including the pilot.
What they consistently says is they thought they hit something, which at this point right now would lead us to believe that what they have heard and felt in the airplane was probably the airplane striking the water again.
Johnson says the NTSB considers 3 main issues in an investigation: human, machine, and environment. And he says so far they have not ruled out any as possible causes of the crash. He says the Otter's Honeywell turbine engine will be sent to a Honeywell factory in Phoenix, Arizona for teardown in October. The NTSB does not expect to release a final report on the accident for another 9 to 12 months. Lawmakers have been expecting a special session on the state's mammoth project to build a natural gas pipeline from the North Slope to an LNG plant in Nikiski. But when Governor Bill Walker called for the special session on Thursday, it came with a surprise: a proposed tax on the natural gas reserves held by the very companies the state is trying to partner with. APRN's Rachel Waldholtz reports.
Governor Bill Walker started his press conference today with a history lesson.
Governor Hickel, a bold move. He threatened the producers on the North Slope. You drill or we will. Drilled, we have Prudhoe Bay today.
The moral of the story? Sometimes getting Alaska's oil and gas out of the ground has required the governor to carry a big stick. That seems to be what Walker is thinking as he proposes a natural gas reserves tax. Walker has been clear he doesn't think the state's partners in the massive Alaska LNG pipeline project are moving fast enough. Those partners include ExxonMobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips, all with major natural gas reserves on the North Slope. A reserves tax would hit any natural gas left undeveloped as an incentive not to leave it in the ground.
This isn't about trying to penalize anybody, trying to put a gun to anybody's head. We have a gun to our own head. on our fiscal situation. It's time to monetize our resources.
It's not entirely clear how the reserves tax would accomplish that, in part because the bill itself hasn't been released yet. The governor says the legislation still has to be reviewed by the Departments of Law and Revenue. But in a report on the project that the governor also released this week, he made it clear he isn't satisfied with the progress on the project so far. One major issue, he says, is that Alaska, with its massive budget deficit, needs the project more than its partners. And so it needs more leverage at the negotiating table. The natural gas reserves tax would give the state that leverage, Walker says. ExxonMobil and BP both issued statements opposing the idea of the reserves tax, and judging from the reaction of key lawmakers, the proposal will have a tough time in the legislature. Senator Kathy Geisel, the Anchorage Republican who chairs the Natural Resources Committee, says she's looking forward to seeing the bill, but her immediate response isn't positive.
I don't believe you can tax a project into existence.
Geisel adds that she was caught off guard by the proposal. She says it didn't come up during two briefings in recent months or at a meeting with the governor on Monday. The governor also wants lawmakers to consider buying out a fourth partner, pipeline builder TransCanada. Geisel says that will be contentious enough. But on one point, at least, she agrees with the governor. With the price of oil so low and so little of it flowing through the Trans-Alaska pipeline, Alaska needs a gas line.
Financially, our state is at a place that we need new income. We need new development of our resources. That's what we're attempting to achieve here. We are striving to work with the governor, but it does require communication, coordination, collaboration.
And for the moment, at least, the project seems short on all three. Reporting in Anchorage from the Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholz.
An international seminar on extractive industries in the Arctic is happening at the University of Alaska Fairbanks this weekend. UAF history professor and seminar organizer Terrence Cole says it's bringing together participants from numerous circumpolar nations to discuss the increasing focus on developing the Arctic's largely untapped resources.
The Arctic and subarctic really is opening up to the outside world in a way that has never occurred before in human history. The Arctic has remained a, sort of a potential warehouse, in part because it was so difficult to get to. But improvements in technology and transportation are changing the equation.
Cole says resource extraction will also be looked at relative to parallel environmental and cultural values and competing governmental jurisdictions.
It really calls for international cooperation on a scale that's really hard to imagine, but in the Arctic we're going to have to.
Cole notes that the United States is playing catch-up in asserting itself in the Arctic relative to other world superpowers like Russia and China.
A late entrant, I suppose, in the race, you know, typified by President Obama saying let's start building some icebreakers. You know, right now we're almost at a 19th century level in our icebreakers with a couple of icebreakers that don't really work so well. We're just not in the same league as China or Russia on that.
The Extractive Industries Seminar is being put on by UAF in conjunction with a network of international higher education institutions known as the University of the Arctic. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, excess heat from a wood-fired boiler fuels a greenhouse at the Thorne Bay School District.
Here's doing it right. One is we're having salad bars every single day at our sites that are products from our greenhouse.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Raven Alaska, providing business travel needs in over 100 communities across the state. Find more at flyraven.com. Alaska oil and gas have a huge impact on all of us, but how much do you really know about them? At akoilandgas.com, you can take an oil and gas IQ quiz and get the facts from reliable sources. This message sponsored by the Alaska Oil and Gas Association.
Fairbanks got its first major snowfall of the season today. As usual, drivers are counting on the state to plow and sand highways and some side roads. But budget cuts mean reduced maintenance. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the downsized operation is expected to be tested this winter.
State Department of Transportation Northern Region spokeswoman Meadow Bailey says maintenance staff overtime has been eliminated, and that will be felt when there's a major winter weather event.
When we have a really
big snowstorm or, you know, freezing rain, we'll have to stay with the scheduled staff and scheduled equipment that we have.
Bailey says backup plow and sanding vehicles will no longer be available.
Reduced our equipment fleet by about 1 million. And what this really means is that we've reduced our essentially our backup equipment. So when we have a piece of equipment that goes down, we don't have something, we would need to work to fix that. We won't have a piece of equipment that can step in and take the place.
Bailey says high volume state roads will continue to be the top maintenance priority, but adds it will take longer for crews to get to less trafficked outlying state roads. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
There have been 4 bear maulings this summer on the Kenai Peninsula. KDLL's Jenny Nyman has more.
A brown bear sow was found dead Wednesday after mauling a 47-year-old Texas man out moose hunting with his brother on the north end of Skelak Lake. Early Tuesday evening, Gregory and Roger Matthews had been separated about 40 yards, making moose calls near Dorishan Bay, when a sow attacked Gregory. According to U.S. Fish and Wildlife officials, Gregory fired at the bear but wasn't sure if he hit it. Roger came to help, and the bear turned on him. Roger shot twice with a .300 Winchester Magnum and believed he struck the bear with both shots. The sow then left the area. Fishermen found the brothers and called in a report at about 6:15 p.m. Gregory was flown to Central Peninsula Hospital with serious but non-life-threatening injuries. Staff reported that he was in good condition late Wednesday. Officials investigated the area Wednesday to see if the bear had been acting defensively, possibly protecting cubs or a food source. The brothers had reported seeing 2 large cubs with the sow. The sow was found dead about 100 yards from the scene, with 2 bullet wounds. The cubs were not found, and the sow didn't appear to be lactating, so the cubs were likely 2 to 3 years old. It was determined to be a defensive attack, U.S. Fish and Wildlife officials said. That's most often the case with bear maulings on the Kenai Peninsula, said Jeff Selinger, area wildlife biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
All the ones since I've been here since 2002 were defensive in nature, where there was a sow with cubs or a bear was in close proximity and, you know, they got spooked and they charged.
Tuesday's incident has been the 4th bear mauling of the year on the peninsula, all happening this summer. On July 22nd, a firefighter working on the Juneau Lake fire near Cooper Landing was attacked by a black bear. On August 4th, a woman out jogging with a friend near the trailhead of the Cottonwood Creek Trail across Skelak Lake was attacked by a brown bear. On September 13th, a man walking a dog in the woods near Mile 11 of Funny River Road was attacked by a brown bear. All these attacks were deemed defensive. Selinger said that 4 attacks a year isn't out of the norm for the Kenai Peninsula, though we've been lucky with few to no attacks in recent years.
The past 3 or 4 years, it's been lower than this. Prior to that, we were averaging about 3 a year, and now we've had 4 so far this year. So we had a little bit of a respite there where we didn't have as many maulings, and then we're back up to where we were from the early 2000s till about 2010.
An uptick in maulings this year doesn't mean there are more bears, Selinger said. If anything, bear numbers have likely decreased on the peninsula due to liberalized hunting opportunities since 2012. In Kenai, I'm Jenny Nyman.
About 5 years ago, the Southeast Island School District in Thorne Bay put in a wood-fired boiler. A few years after, they built a greenhouse to take advantage of the excess heat. This summer, the greenhouse transitioned from hydroponics to aquaponics. KRBD's Ruth Eddie spoke with students and teachers on Prince of Wales Island about growing food for themselves and their communities.
A while back, a Thorne Bay father visiting Ketchikan brought back a handful of McDonald's burgers, which for kids on the remote island is a treat. There was an extra cheeseburger and it was left at the school, where it still is today, more than a year later, in Megan Fitzpatrick's classroom.
So we actually have put samples of regular food next to the cheeseburger to show that real food rots. And this McDonald's cheeseburger looks exactly the same as it did the day it was delivered here.
Real food rots has become a motto. And the real food they used as a comparison was grown about 100 yards away from her classroom in the school's greenhouse.
This is the greenhouse. We're just starting out.
This summer, the greenhouse transitioned from hydro to aquaponics. The difference? Fish. Ammonia from goldfish waste is converted to nitrogen and distributed as fertilizer to the plants before it's recirculated to create a complete ecosystem. This year, the 7 high school-aged students taking the greenhouse class will be focusing on that ecosystem.
What we do is we have different groups of kids each year or each semester. We find out what their needs are, what their interests are, and we try and tailor it to what they need and what they're interested in.
The first year, the class was like a business. The next year, the focus was plant science. Fitzpatrick says it's always about trying to grow food. It's just framed differently.
This is what I look forward to every day, like coming out, seeing what it's doing every day. And kids are keeping records. Yesterday they were doing some water quality analysis, and they have to graph it all out. They keep a little data sheet.
Thorn Bay isn't the only school on the island with a greenhouse. The Southeast Island School District also funded aquaponics greenhouses in Kasan and Nakati, and is currently building the flagship greenhouse in Kaufman Cove. To make sure operations got off the ground smoothly, the district hired a greenhouse manager. Coulter Barnes came from Western Alaska as a principal who also operated a small organic farm. He says his job is to do right by the district's investment.
Here's doing it right. One is we're having salad bars every single day at our sites that are products from our greenhouses. Carrots, radishes, green onions, turnips, beets, you know, lettuces, chard.
With some school populations at less than 20, Barnes says school greenhouses likely will produce more food than the students can eat. And the district is using the excess to teach, too. The Thorn Bay greenhouse has sold excess lettuce to local fishing lodges, grocery stores, and restaurants, including the district's own Thorn Bay Cafe.
When the school district bought it, obviously the place needed to be remodeled. It's a 15-foot-wide trailer.
Susan Powell had worked in and owned restaurants before moving to Prince of Wales last year to work at the only restaurant in the 500-person town.
Burger up.
Flowers from outside hang in the doorway. True Love started working as a waitress at the cafe shortly after the cafe reopened. She's quick to say being a waitress isn't her dream job, but she's grateful for the experience.
There's not a lot of job opportunities here, and like with school, it is very flexible and stuff like that. So,
for instance, she's also taking a scuba class through the school, and occasionally it will run late. Powell says she's flexible because students are the priority.
We will give students income because they're working for us, and we'll give them skills. So when they leave the island, you can go someplace and say you have work experience and you know how to do this.
While the greenhouse class is reserved for older kids, every grade level gets their hands a bit dirty. Kindergartners help with the planting and middle schoolers help with the harvesting. Fitzpatrick says the greenhouse has made a difference in the eating habits not only of students, but also of the community.
It was so fresh and it was so delicious. And people almost didn't recognize it as lettuce, you know, compared to what we've been experiencing.
For the greenhouse going up in Kaufman Cove, the plan is to have open doors for the community, possibly a place to sit, because even besides the food and education opportunities, being in a warm environment surrounded by plants and fish is good for any age. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Ruth Eddy.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Rural CAP commemorates 50 years of delivering early childhood education programs like Head Start and Parents as Teachers. Signature housing programs, including weatherization, self-help housing, and permanent affordable housing, make a difference in our communities. AmeriCorps members and elder mentors have positive impacts to education, health, and the environment. Learn more at ruralcap.com. This message is sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Aleknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Jeremy Shea. This week on AK, science. High school students in Kodiak are doing college or maybe even PhD level science. WorldBridge is a NASA-sponsored group that assigns Alaskan students to scientific research projects. At a recent competition in Italy, the group showed that their earthquake research could have a global impact. But that's only one project they're working on. They've also entered the world of nanoagriculture. KMXT's Kayla DeRoche has the story.
High school junior Anna McDonald sprays an organic fertilizer over a sad-looking patch of grass on a baseball field. The solution isn't a chemical, just a combination of microorganisms, sea kelp, and mineral electrolytes. Anna says microbes do all the work.
Like an earthworm just eats the toxic soil and digests it, and it comes out, and it's perfectly balanced, perfectly natural, just how the earth is made to function.
Anna and two other students look like exterminators or ghostbusters, carrying the fertilizer in plastic backpacks, which Anna says they bought off Amazon. The team has already treated eight other fields, and so far, Anna says the fertilizer seems to be working.
There was one area that was completely bare, and we treated it with this enzyme. And then we came back in 4 weeks to measure our data and get our results and see what had happened. And it had grown back completely. It was full and green, and it looked better than the surrounding area.
Anna and a handful of other students partnered with the fertilizer's company to spray a local golf course. Why this product? Well, Anna says, the company reached out to them, but also,
we were very interested in what we could do with it, and we wanted to see what it would do for ourselves instead of just reading about it in a paper.
Anna says she's especially interested in chemistry and the way it can be applied in real-world situations, which is why she loves nanoagriculture. While spraying the field, a young student recognizes her.
I am. Ron and I have gone to some middle school classes before to talk to kids about nanoag and also studying marine debris.
She means Ron Fortunato, the creator of WorldBridge, an Alaska STEM program that develops partners in business and industry and then creates real-world projects in school districts. Fortunato is based in New Jersey, but he worked on a project in Juneau School District, and the positive experience and interest in further collaborations from other people in the state led him to Alaska once again for WorldBridge. Fortunato says officials with the Kodiak Island School District jumped at the chance to get involved in WorldBridge. And this summer, a group of Kodiak high schoolers traveled to Como, Italy to present earthquake data at the Europa Challenge. It's a competition sponsored in part by NASA, along with other international organizations, and it usually only accepts university students or industry professionals. Fortunato says they made an exception for the group.
The researchers that were there, the universities, all the professionals who were there, they didn't talk to them like they were high school students. There was a full measure of respect and welcome into the community of that geospatial community, which is a big international group there. And it wasn't that they were looking at them as students. They were looking at their work.
The Kodiak team won that competition. With the help of NASA and other sponsors, WorldBridge's Kodiak students have a lot of resources at their fingertips. I dropped by their lab in the Alaska Department of Fish and Game building, and there's a 3D printer set up on one table and a drone on another. In other words, it's every science buff's fantasy. Anna gives me a tour.
This is the NanoAg bench. Since most of our work is done in the field, this is just kind of where we are able to sit at our computers and write up reports or decipher all of our data. And it's where we store our enzyme and then our other supplies.
And if you're wondering where WorldBridge is headed from here, well, it's all ongoing. And as another student, Senior Levi Purdy, explains, they're a team like any other research group.
Both the professionals and the students and the teachers, we're all learning above what we understand. We're all experimenting and testing hypotheses, and we're all trying to solve a problem.
Check the sources the next time you read a study online or a news article. You may be surprised by who collected that data. For 8K, I'm Kayla DeRoche.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week, we're hearing from Judy Donegan, who's lived in Palmer for 6 years.
Well, my son has lived here for a long time. He built a house for me and basically told me that as I got older, if he was going to have to take care of me, I was going to have to come here. Well, I had visited many times, and I really liked it. He had a six-month-old son at the time, and my thought was, I really want to try this. And the other part is that we live off the electrical grid. So I moved from the 17th floor of a downtown high-rise on Lake Michigan to a place off the grid off Buffalo Mine Road outside Palmer. And my thought was, we'll see if I can do this, and if I can't, I'll just have to go back. But I wanted to try. What I would like people to know is that it's not that hard. It might be harder to move here if you move from, say, Florida. But when you move from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, the weather isn't that much different. And the important thing is that if you have solar panels and a battery, living off the electrical grid is not that hard. I don't have a dishwasher, but I don't miss that. I don't miss anything but my hair dryer. It's 10 miles out of Palmer, but it is a neighborhood. So I have nearby neighbors who I like a lot. My son lives nearby. The difference is I can't walk half a block to a really good restaurant or walk three blocks to the symphony. And it surprises me as much as anyone that I'm okay with that. I grew up in a small town and couldn't wait to get out and get to the city. But now I'm very happy where I am.
Judy Donegan lives off the grid in Palmer. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. If you want to share your story, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Kayla DeRoche, Ann Hillman, Dave Waldron, and Annie Fight. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Jeremy Shea.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Rachel Waldholtz and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Jenny Nyman in Kenai, and Ruth Eddy in Ketchikan. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Ann Hillman. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. October 6th is REAA Election Day. Polls are open 8 a.m. until 8 p.m. You'll be voting for REAA school board candidates. When you go to vote, bring identification. If your name is not on the list or you don't have ID, you may vote a question ballot. The question ballot updates your voter registration. If you need language or other assistance while voting, ask the election board or bring somebody to assist you. This message sponsored by the Division of Elections.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.